Good evening to you all. This is the annual International History Lecture, and we are extremely lucky to have with us David Blackman, who is, well, I'm going to get the title wrong, Coolidge Professor of History, I've got it right, at Harvard University, and also a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Not quite sure how to introduce David. Perhaps I should say that his last book was called The Conquest of Nature, Landscape and the Making of Modern Germany. But I suppose, I hope Richard Evans isn't in the audience, the best way to introduce David is to say that he's the most distinguished professor of German history in the English-speaking world. And what he's going to talk to us about is actually a rather narrow subject. It's called Germany in the World, 1500 to 2000, Outlines of a Transnational History. David, we're very happy to have you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chai. I'm sure if Richard was here, he'd have announced himself by now. Thank you for that introduction. I first came to London University 35 years ago, not to the LSE, but to Queen Mary and then to Birkbeck. It's a long time ago. James Joel was still in his prime at the LSE when I came. He was a mentor to me, and many of us still miss him very much. David Starkey was active in the university back then and already enjoyed a formidable reputation, but not much beyond the bounds of the History Board of Examiners, I think. So since then, things have also changed. Nobody wants to listen to a book prospectus, so I'm not going to offer you that. But I want to try and talk through some of the issues that arise in contemplating this project, Germany in the World, 1500 to 2000, on which I hope to write a fairly short book on this very large subject. And let me begin with a quotation from Goethe and Schiller, from their Aeneid of 1796. Germany, but where is it? I don't know where to find the country. Where the learned begins, the political ends. Now, I don't need to tell this audience that the German cultural nation preceded the German nation state, that the borders of Germany were less defined than those of Britain or France, or that Germany was the belated nation. Today I want to approach the German question from a different angle, from a transnational perspective. Where did German history happen? Do the contours of that history look different if we examine the flows of people, and indeed of non-human species, of commodities, ideas, and practices into and out of German-speaking Europe? Now, transnational has become a buzzword among historians. What's driving this interest in transnational history and its near cousins, the history of transfer and entangled history, l'histoire croisée? Is there a connection between scholars who live in a world of border-crossing networks and their propensity to emphasize motion and movement and flux? It's certainly true that if history developed as a discipline in tandem with the nation state, then a more post-national world is summoning a different kind of history. Debates over European integration have demonstrably had their effect. Ute Freiwirth and others have pondered the Europeanization of German history. The danger is something that resembles a bland version of European civics, or worse, a history that assumes some kind of European civilizational unity, like the preamble to Giscard d'Estaing's European Constitution, of which it's been said that forcing school students to read it breaches the ban on cruel and unusual punishment. But there's something else at work that's truly global, namely how the emergence of post-colonial multicultural societies in Europe has led to new perspectives. It's a cliché that British and French history have been transformed in the last generation by bringing the colonies back in. And that's happened in smaller countries, Portugal, the Netherlands. Now, Germany is a special case. Its formal empire was short-lived and ended in 1919. But brief though it was, there's been a surge of recent work on German colonies and their domestic repercussions. And it's also true that the imperialist imaginary was at work in Germany before and after the era of formal colonies. And it could at least be argued, I would argue it, that the true German Empire was located in Eastern Europe. And bringing that history back in has affected, does affect, our view of Germany. Now, these contemporary shifts, our alertness to movements of people and diasporas, perhaps especially our recognition of how identities are unstable and shifting, they've nurtured interest in transnational history. But there are two other developments within our discipline that I want to mention. The first is a renewed recognition of geography. History takes place in space as well as time. The long neglect of this truth by German historians is understandable, given the past misuse of the term space, Raum. The geographer Walter Kristaller warned in the 1930s about mythologizing this, as he called it, fashionable word. And I quote Kristaller, "Precisely because space has become a longing of our time, it easily seduces even scholars," I like that, even scholars, "into wanting to use the slogan space to explain everything." But this is one of many instances in which we need to reclaim terms like space, solid by National Socialism. I sometimes feel that that's my life work to do this. The second development I want to mention is the 1980s constructivist turn, which insisted that nations were imagined and invented. This led us to look in new ways at both subnational, first of all, and then increasingly supranational identities, and to question how uniform identities really were. What did it mean, for example, to be a German in 1900 if you were also a Palatine and a Bavarian, but also had an uncle in Milwaukee and relations who'd settled in the Banat 2 centuries earlier? For me, at least, one of the great intellectual excitements of this liberation from the straitjacket of the nation as a kind of self-evident unit of inquiry has been the invitation to play with scales, Jacques Revel's jeu d'échelle. From microhistory to big history, we've become more aware of why scale matters, how we see things differently according to the scale being used, whether turning the magnification up or down, zooming in or panning out. These thoughts already suggest some of the reasons why, even when national borders are clearly defined, there are problems with histories of a nation written as if that history took place entirely within those borders. As Tom Bender put it in his recent Transnational History of America, the nation cannot be its own context. The idea of a nation as container misses the movement of people, goods, and ideas across borders. It overlooks the porousness of borders, underplays zones of contact and exchange, and favors the homogeneous over the hybrid. It also makes it easier to underestimate commonalities, the history a nation shares with other nations. So in this talk, I want to give a sketch only, of what might be included in a transnational history of Germany since 1500. Let me begin with the German lands in the early modern period. So transnational history in the pre-national age. This is what the humanist Johann Cochleus wrote about Nuremberg in 1512. "The city lies equidistant between the Adriatic and the Baltic, by which one measures the breadth of Europe, and it is also halfway between the Don and Cadiz, which are the measure of Europe's length." Now, we can, of course, see this as standard expression of local pride, of which there was no shortage in the Nuremberg of Dürer and Cochleus. But it's true that the early modern German lands straddled many of the great fault lines in Europe, the worlds of southern and northern humanism, the confessional divide, the legal conditions on the land that divided Europe into areas east and west of the River Elbe. Germany was the land in the middle. Fenon Proudel called it the German Isthmus, the great contact zone, the crossroads where cultures and people met. Germans migrated, travelled, studied, and traded north, south, east, and west. Merchants were engaged in the North Sea and Baltic carrying trade. They also had strong links over the Alps to Italy, trading in Venice and Milan. German students enrolled in universities across Europe. German scholars formed a big part of the Republic of Letters, stitched together by travel and the exchange of books and letters. One thinks of Johannes Kepler in the cosmopolitan Prague of Rudolf II, where he was successor to the Dane, Tycho Brahe, himself educated in the German lands, where he corresponded with Galileo in Padua, was surrounded by a motley group of Bohemian and Hungarian courtiers, Italian humanists, Dutch inventors of perpetuum mobile machines, and alchemists from across Europe. During the 30 Years' War, which upended Kepler's life as it upended so many scholars, and not only scholars' lives, the learned became even more mobile. The Prussian Samuel Hartlib, who was called the greatest information gatherer in Europe, Hartlib settled in England, became one of the founding spirits of the Royal Society, and sat at the centre of a great network of European correspondents. At a humbler social level, German journeymen, itinerant tradesmen, travelling musicians, more on musicians later, shepherds, pilgrims and preachers, all of these were on the move across those porous early modern borders. For of course it's wrong to think of early modern society as immobile, it was simply mobile in different ways from our society. Well, let me now zoom in for a moment on German connections with the Netherlands, which were many. In the 16th century and into the 17th, when it was superseded by Italy, the Netherlands was the most influential model for German music, still then in a kind of subaltern position. Dutch artistic taste was equally powerful. There's a research project at the University of Greifswald just completed on cultural exchange between Western Europe and the Baltic, and it's shown how Danzig and Hamburg became the great intermediaries in the transmission of Dutch paintings, sculptures, furniture, pattern books, and much else to the Dutch and Danish and Polish markets. And while Hanseatic merchants were engaged in this, German itinerant traders from Westphalia were engaged in a highly developed system of seasonal trade. It was called the Tudden system, selling textiles and metal goods in the Netherlands and all along the North Sea coast. Scores of thousands of men from Northwest Germany also went each year as seasonal Hollandgänger, literally people who go to Holland. They returned, so it was said, as tobacco users with loose morals, those Dutch. They went to cut peat. Peat is an essential energy source for the Dutch economy, which helped to lay the basis of Dutch overseas expansion. Just as the German timber floated down the Rhine on giant rafts in these years to build Dutch ships, made an essential contribution to Dutch power in the Golden Age. And just as did the many Germans who served aboard Dutch merchant vessels, whaling ships, warships, and the Germans who served in the Dutch East Indies. Now, this raises the question about the German contribution to the new world that Europeans started to create in the late 15th century. Mostly this has been told as a history of what didn't happen. This is also the story of my life, telling the story of what didn't happen in German history. While the Portuguese and Spanish, so the story goes, were embarked on voyages of discovery, Germans were engaged in the Schmalkaldic War. And Germans were otherwise engaged at home while the Dutch, French, and British constructed the next big thing, namely the Atlantic economy. Now, I think this picture needs revision. Think of the famous Nuremberger Martin Bahaim, who served the crown of Portugal, taking part in the 1482 expedition to the west coast of Africa. Bahaim was one of the many, very many, German cartographers and instrument makers who contributed to the expanding European mastery of the oceans. And Germans turn up in the historical record everywhere you look, in fact, sailing with Magellan and in virtually every North American settlement, whether British, Dutch, French, or Swedish. Now, later German nationalists often exaggerated the achievements of these Germans serving under non-German flags, and that's obviously unhistorical, and it was often extremely dubious politically. And yet, if we see these men, and they were all men, as they were, as Nurembergers and Oldenburgers, shouldn't we recognize this German role in this, the making of this new world? Can we discount it simply because it was not German flagged? And German merchants also had a major role in the making of the Atlantic economy, at home and as residents of Lisbon and Antwerp, Amsterdam and London. Now, the German lands played no direct part in the Atlantic slave trade and plantation economy, but they were, like other parts of Northwest Europe, complicit in that trade, and they were at the same time transformed by the new culture of consumption based on sugar, coffee, and tobacco, right through to Bach's Coffee Cantata, which, had I brought fancy equipment, I would have been playing at this point. Now, I've so far said nothing beyond a brief reference to pilgrims and preachers about the Reformation. This is the, as it were, the mirror image of how the making of the new world is usually treated. This is appears usually in the German history books as an intensely inward-looking German affair. And that's true whether the focus is on Martin Luther and the German nation, the Reformation in the cities, confessionalization, all the different phases of Reformation historiography. And yet the history of the Reformation that's starting to emerge elsewhere, and particularly in Britain, thinking here of Andrew Pettigrew and Ewan Cameron, that's a history of an explosive European, and indeed extra-European movement, out of Germany. The confessional line was first drawn in Germany, but the new faith and then the confessional strife that followed spread across Europe to Switzerland, France, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, the British Isles, and so on. We're increasingly well informed about the European-wide networks, the circulation of people, ideas, and practices among Lutherans and Zwinglians, and especially among Calvinists. Religious divisions elsewhere were then imported back into the German lands, in the form of war, of course, the Thirty Years' War, but also when the victims of religious persecution sought refuge, like the Dutch exiles in 16th century Emden, and much more famously, the Huguenots, who played such a major role in the development of Prussia. Protestantism also spawned movements of renewal. Quakers, Mennonites, the Herrnhuter, Lutheran Pietists, that connected German lands with other parts of Europe and with the Atlantic world. It was the German-Dutch Mennonite connection that created the first solidly German North American settlement that was Germantown, 1683. The same Mennonite merchants who created the network through which larger-scale German emigration to the New World began in the 18th century, from the 1720s. An even larger part in knitting together the Atlantic world was played by the Pietist networks, these preachers, pharmacists, and couriers, an extraordinary network of couriers, who radiated out from Prussian Halle to Britain, the American colonies, the Caribbean, and West Africa. Finally, the Catholic Reformation, Counter-Reformation, was also imported back into Germany as an artistic style as well as a spiritual movement from Southern Europe, just as it placed Germans alongside other Europeans, both within Europe and beyond, as Jesuit missionaries, for example, in China. So writing the transnational history of Germany in the early modern period means confronting head-on the European and even global conflicts within Christianity, conflicts that were very much made in Germany. Now, as I turn from the 18th century to the 19th, perhaps a word on the transition from the one century to the other, what Germans call the Sattelzeit, the saddle period. I think historians, there's been a shift here. Historians now tend to see this period on either side of 1800 and going back to the 1750s even, as a period whose importance transcends even the industrial and French revolutions, as an era of warfare-generated revolutionary upheaval in the Americas, Europe, and beyond, an era of proto-globalization, this is Christopher Bailey, and, to use Drew Warman's phrase, a time that saw the invention of the modern self. Again, though, Germany is remarkably absent, absent from all those books and essay collections on the Atlantic Revolution, almost entirely absent from Chris Bailey's very rich global history, and entirely absent from Drew Warman's wonderful book, a book, though, which deals entirely with Britain, France, and the American colonies. There's an urgent need to put the German experience into this story where it belongs. And that includes examining the linkages between a period of global change and the extraordinary flowering of German literature and thought in the 25 years on either side of 1800, a flowering probably unequaled except in ancient Greece. And with that, let me turn to the 19th century and the era of nationalism. Prasenjit Dwara has called for rescuing history from the nation, his term. Now, that doesn't mean rejecting the nation as an analytical category any more than being interdisciplinary means rejecting your discipline. It does mean recognizing that nations and nation states were made and remade to a significant degree by transnational forces and not just by wars and treaties. The rise of the national movement and the creation of a nation state were central to 19th century German history. Yet the unified Germany of the 19th century, like Meiji Japan, like the post-bellum USA, came into being within a globalizing world. Indeed, going back to the liberal imperialists of 1848, German nationalist writers, officials, merchants, and naval officers called for the creation of a German nation state, in part because they believed the existing German state system was inadequate to protect German national interests in the face of global threats, as they saw it. The global and the national were interconnected. Well, I want to move to examine some of those interconnections, and let me start with migration. Germans had a major part in what I'd like to call the great Völkerwanderung of the 19th century. 4.5 million Germans left their homes between the 1840s and 1900. 4.5 million. 4 million of them went to the USA. Brazil is a very distant second. The Germans in America established newspapers, gymnastic and choral societies, theaters, and, of course, beer gardens. This was more a transplanting than an uprooting. The conscious cultivation of German identity in Little Germanists continued right through to, really, to First World War. What repercussions, I want to ask, did this German diaspora have back home? Institutionally, it created a powerful German market for those like emigration agents and shipping lines who dealt in this human traffic. It brought growing state oversight of emigration, and it also, less obviously, contributed through the Gustavus Adolphus Association and the St. Raphael Association, which supported their respective Protestant and Catholic diasporas. It contributed to what's been called the reconfessionalization of German society. Much harder to determine is the impact on Germans at home of things like emigrants' letters, personal accounts of their American experiences, which supplemented the ads of the emigration agents and the many popular books like Friedrich Gerstecker's Nach Amerika, To America. An idea of America obviously lodged itself in the minds of 19th century Germans. The growing Saarland coalfield was nicknamed Black California. The town of Wilhelmshaven, which I wrote about in The Conquest of Nature, created out of nothing in the 1860s, was called Little America. Books like Ludwig Max Goldberger's Land of Unlimited Opportunities travel reports, best-selling westerns, not just by Carl May. All of these offered a series of mirrors, or perhaps distorting mirrors, in which Germans could observe their own society. Now, the scale of German transatlantic emigration has, I think, overshadowed the continuing importance of German migration within Europe. German settlements in southern Russia continued into the early 19th century. At that time, there were also still around 20,000 German Hollandgänger going to the Netherlands. And in 1850, there were 100,000 Germans living in Paris, which made Paris the sixth largest German city of the time. When they finally returned in the 1880s, at the same time that emigration to America also ebbed, it marked a symbolic reversal. Germany was now a country of immigrants, not of emigrants. Dutch and Italians worked in very large numbers in the west of the country, but it was the Polish seasonal laborers in the east whose presence had the greatest impact. And they provide a key to some of the central debates still of Imperial Germany. Prussia versus Germany, agriculture versus industry, Junkers versus bourgeoisie. But that's not all. The border-crossing mass movement of Poles led to growing state regimentation and surveillance, and to ugly complaints about the Slav flood. Meanwhile, Pan-Germans were not alone in complaining that the German emigrants who'd gone to the USA had been lost to the nation, and in demanding German colonies as places of German, truly German, emigration. Now, the largest contingent of German colonists in Southwest Africa numbered only 12,000. Yet, colonies also had their effect on German debates about national identity. This is, I think, especially true from recent research, especially true when it came to the question of racially mixed marriages. And it was against the background, both of these explosive migratory movements in general, and the debates they unleashed, that the notorious blood-based German citizenship law of 1913 was passed. I want to turn from migration to the domestic repercussions of something else, namely German participation in world trade in the 19th century. Now, the broad story here is familiar. The growing German presence within a burgeoning world economy made possible by the steamship, the telegraph, undersea cables, and so on. Between 1880 and 1913, German imports increased fourfold. Exports slightly less, the balance is filled by invisible earnings from repatriated profits of all those German businesses overseas, and the income derived from something else in which Germans were very active in the world, namely very large international construction projects, and not just the Baghdad Railway, Latin America, Spain, elsewhere. The German merchant marine, smaller than Spain's in 1880, was four times larger than the American just 30 years later. A global network of German shipping lines, agents, and coaling stations underlay the apparently unstoppable rise of the Made in Germany brand. That's the export side. But the imports that often originated thousands of miles away, reached down into everyday life and reshaped how Germans viewed the world. That's most obviously true of so-called colonial goods. Like popular literature and the colorful images employed by the new advertising industry, there's a wonderful, wonderful new book on this by David Cialo, published by the Harvard Press. These colonial goods gave Germans a taste of the exotic. But even the plainest of foodstuffs, bread and meat, have a story to tell. The wheat shipped from the North American prairie across the ocean to the giant mills in Mannheim, and the meat now delivered from the USA and Argentina, thanks to refrigeration, these had their effects not only on German diet, they had reverberations in German politics and the German way of life. At a time when economic interest groups played an increasing role in political parties and decision making, when even the language of politics began to echo the language of business the political broker, the political mass market, and so on. Some of the fiercest debates over Germany's future concerned trade treaties and tariffs, imports. Look at the slogans that animated social political debate: Manchesterism, Mittelstandspolitik, the protection of national labour, and it's clear that they marked out competing views about Germany's place in the world economy. And these were all debates that began with economics, but spread quickly into arguments about town versus country, social stability, even German identity. I want to develop this point for a moment in a different direction. One of the arguments used by protectionists to keep out foreign produce was the safety argument, the veterinary argument. You had to keep out dangerous foreign meats and animals. The arguments were always self-interested, but they weren't always spurious. Increasing quantities of food and animal imports did, in fact, carry risks to indigenous human and animal populations. Just as plant diseases like phylloxera entered Germany in these years, and aquatic invasive species began to arrive, stowing away on the hulls or in the ballast tanks of transoceanic ships. This all sounds very contemporary. This is the era when the scare about invasive species really begins, in the later 19th century. These presented serious problems. They also lent themselves to political misuse. The line between invasive species and subgroups of the human species started to become blurred in contemporary debate. During the, this is one of my favorite quotations in 35 years of reading about German history. During the Kulturkampf in the 1870s, one liberal anti-clerical included phylloxera, Colorado beetle, and the Jesuits together as enemies of the Reich. Catholics were dehumanized before they were persecuted, just as Jews began to be referred to as vermin, Ungeziefer, by followers of the new pseudo-scientific anti-Semitism. Now, I've been talking about the domestic impact of German migration and participation in the world economy, the effect back on Germany. But I think there are cases where the opposite occurred. That's to say, where the German national movement and the creation of a nation state had a decisive effect on the role that Germans played in the world. And I want to illustrate that by considering perhaps a less familiar group of people, a very special group of German travelers, namely explorers. I want to take five men, very briefly, five men whose journeys to different parts of the earth took place over a period of more than 100 years, from the late 18th century to the later 19th, and ask what we can learn about changes over time. The five are Carsten Niebuhr, Alexander von Humboldt, inevitably, Ludwig Leichhardt, Gerhard Rolfs, and Karl Koldewey. Niebuhr's seven-year journey to Arabia in the late 18th century was a Danish undertaking that also involved Swedish as well as German participants. He was the only German. Niebuhr himself, the only survivor, received essential help from the British in India and in Egypt and in Bombay, and he became celebrated throughout Europe. So a cosmopolitan figure. Humboldt, of course, is the most famous of this quintet, now even more famous because of Daniel Kehlmann's best-selling novel, Measuring the Earth. Humboldt's classic Travels to the Equinoctial Regions of the New Continent was the result of a journey undertaken between 1799 and 1804 with his French friend Aimé Bonpland. It was first published in French, the language that Humboldt spoke better than he spoke German, and Humboldt himself lived in Paris for more than two decades before returning rather reluctantly to Berlin. So Niebuhr and Humboldt had different social origins, but both belonged to a cosmopolitan world of learning and scientific networks. The same can be said of Ludwig Leichhardt. He's less well known than the first two, though he was in fact the model for the German explorer in Patrick White's great novel, Voss. Leichhardt was the son of a Brandenburg peat inspector. That sounds like something created by Tedo Fontana, doesn't it? The peat inspector. Peat inspector's son, who felt suffocated in his domestic Prussia, he also wanted to avoid military service, he befriended a young Englishman, a merchant's son, a Bristol merchant's son, William Nicholson, whom he followed to England. And he wrote glowing letters back to his family in Brandenburg about the kind of the energy and the openness to the world of Bristol and London, the two cities that he lived in. The two young friends were originally going to go to Australia together, but Nicholson chose to stay behind. He gave Leichhardt his life savings, and Leichhardt went off to Australia, where he made his name, but eventually lost his life in 1848. It's wonderfully described in Patrick White's novel. Leichhardt, I think, fits the emerging model of the scientific explorer as a kind of man of action, not just a learned man. But he remained untouched by nationalist sentiment. Now, move forward to my penultimate figure, Gerhard Rolfs, another restless youth like Leichhardt. But Rolfs became famous, he was an Africa explorer, he became famous very much within the context of German achievements. Unlike other earlier Africa explorers from Germany, like Heinrich Barth, who was an Anglophile, a cosmopolitan, Rolfs was an ardent nationalist. He made his journeys in the 1860s and 70s, and his popular lectures and books made him a figure of great celebrity within Germany, very much as a German national hero. Which brings me finally to the fifth figure, Karl Koldewey. Koldewey led the first two German North Pole expeditions, so from Africa to the North Pole. The second and more successful of these expeditions set off in 1869. Both Bismarck and Wilhelm I were there to wave them goodbye in Bremerhaven, and they returned triumphantly in 1870, having wintered over in pack ice, to find the Franco-Prussian War underway, and their whole status changed by this fact. The chairman of the expedition committee toasted their return in these words: "We can now look with pride and joy on the achievements of the sailors and scientists. They have gloriously demonstrated German nautical proficiency, German persistence, and German striving for the enrichment of science," the nationalist adjective unmistakable. After 1870, it was hard for any German journey of exploration, even the most scientific, to escape the nimbus of the national cause. What's true of the trajectory of this very specific German engagement with the world also holds true, I would say, in the larger realm of intellectual exchange and cultural transfer. In the 19th century, German philosophy, German forestry, German military prowess, the German research university, and certainly not least, German music, enjoyed widespread worldwide renown. German ideas and practices went around the globe. They made Germany a magnet for others and excited admiration. English literary notables, from Coleridge and Carlyle to George Eliot and Matthew Arnold, looked to Germany. I thought it was only in Harvard that shopping period led to people walking out two-thirds of the way through a lecture. Not only the English literary notables through to Matthew Arnold, the American transcendentalists, the intellectuals of mid-century, also were besotted by Germany, fixated on German culture. That's the thought, the literature. But turning to forestry, when Britain needed a forester for the Indian Raj, it looked to the so-called fatherland of forestry and picked a German, Dietrich Brandis. The first school of forestry in the USA was founded by the German Carl Schenck. Some 10,000 Germans, some 10,000 Americans earned PhDs at German universities in the 19th century. And when Harvard's greatest president, Eliot, wanted to modernize the university in the late 19th century, he went out and hired German professors and emulated the German model. The new rulers of Meiji Japan sent tens of thousands of Japanese medical students to study in Berlin, and invited German doctors to establish medical education in Japan. Now, as the 19th century wore on, these and many other examples of German prestige fed national pride, even hubris, especially after unification, another example where the politics affected the non-political realm. Now, it's true that even as political tension rose among the great powers at the end of the 19th century, transnational cultural networks continued to become more dense, cultural exchanges to intensify. And in this, culture, if you want, resembled economics. Many of these movements of people and ideas bore an internationalist stamp. I'm thinking of the Germans who played such a big role in the international women's movement, and the great receptivity of many Germans around 1900 to non-German influences in art and design, literature, dance, architecture, and so on. And yet, these cultural borrowings also now prompted resistance, like the nationalist backlash against architect Hermann Muthesius, who'd lived in both Tokyo and London, after the appearance of his book Das Englische Haus, which praised English vernacular architecture. Or what happened, this is a common pattern, or foreign ideas were appropriated in ways that made them more German, even belligerently German. And the best example here is sport. German sport was simultaneously less aristocratic, more professional, but also more militarized than the English original. And finally, cultural links and institutional connections of this kind did not necessarily build bridges across political divides. The son of British Prime Minister Asquith and the son of German Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg were both students at Balliol College, Oxford. They would both be killed within a few weeks of each other on the Western Front. And with that, I come to the short 20th century. The term denotes, of course, the period that began with the First World War and ended with the fall of the Berlin Wall and German reunification. There, in a nutshell, is a reminder of how the 20th century was, after all, the German century, although not at all for the reasons that many Germans would have foreseen around 1900, when German prestige and respect stood probably higher than ever before or since. There's much to be said about the Germany and the world in the 20th century, but I think I should clearly begin these final remarks by talking about war, unavoidably. It might seem obvious that the transnational threads of the 19th century were in fact snapped in this age of catastrophe, Eric Hobsbawm's term, before being picked up again after 1945. There's a temptation in writing about Germany and the world in the 20th century to jump from the globalizing pre-1914 world to the world of recovery after 1945, to an example of the kind of the cosmopolitan re-engagement of Germany with the world. I think that's wrong. I've already tried to suggest in this lecture that the border-crossing transnational dimension of history is not synonymous with simply what's cosmopolitan and attractive to us, nice transnationalism, if you want. I would say quite the contrary. The transnational perspective is actually especially helpful for understanding Germany in the era of world wars and national socialism. Let me give you two examples. First, Germany obviously shaped global politics by war. It also helped to make these conflicts truly global by its appeal to colonial peoples. In the First World War, Germany already armed and supported Indian nationalists, just as it encouraged Irish nationalists and sent figures like Wilhelm Wasmus, the German Lawrence of Arabia, to the Persian Gulf. These connections continued after 1918. Berlin became a major center for colonial students, intellectuals, and would-be revolutionaries. That's especially true of Charlottenburg, or Little Asia, as it was called in the 20s. There were 1,000 Chinese, mainly living near Kantstrasse in the 20s. A smaller number of Vietnamese. Both Xu Enlai and Ho Chi Minh lived in Berlin in the early 1920s. There were also Iranians, Egyptians, and especially Indians. Some 400 students, intellectuals, and nationalists, including some of the leading figures to emerge from the Swadeshi nationalist modernist milieu of pre-1914 Calcutta. Berlin, as my former student Chris Manjapra has demonstrated, was a central node in the global network of Indian anti-colonialism. We're familiar with the idea of the Bolshevik Revolution as a beacon of anti-colonial struggle, and we know that the USA aroused brief hopes for the self-determination of non-European peoples during the Wilsonian moment. But Germany was also a lodestar for anti-colonial aspirations. It attracted those who saw themselves as also the victims of Anglo-Saxon imperial arrogance. For the Indians and Chinese of Charlottenburg, Germany had the great virtue that it wasn't Britain. It was, in fact, the anti-Britain. Like the idea that elective affinities existed between Germans and Native Americans, a powerful idea in Germany, these mental projections deserve attention, both as a set of German views about themselves and as a form of German mystique in the eyes of at least some non-white peoples. These ideas preceded and in some cases persisted beyond the Third Reich. As for the Indian and other revolutionary intellectuals, many stayed in Germany after 1933. German support for the anti-British army of Subhash Chandra Bose in the Second World War was one outcome. But the impact of the formerly German-based colonial intellectuals was far more widespread, especially in Asia, and it's only now starting to be studied. That's one example. My second example is migration, a subject with truly German dimensions. It would be hard to exaggerate the extent to which 20th century history as a whole was shaped by the tumultuous movements of populations across German borders. The scale of these migrations was unprecedented. After the First World War, around 850,000 Germans moved from areas that were now Polish or French back into the reduced German state, while a smaller number of Poles from areas like the Ruhr moved in the opposite direction. Then, after 1933, some 400,000 Germans emigrated as a result of political or racial persecution. And I want for a moment to put a human face on this. This movement included a young man called Peter Fröhlich, whose Berlin family traveled in April 1939 via Antwerp, Southampton, Cherbourg, and Lisbon to Havana, where they joined more than 3,000 German Jewish emigres before they finally landed in Florida at the beginning of 1941. Peter Fröhlich became Peter Gay, one of the most distinguished European historians in the USA. And of course, there are many great historians among this emigre generation, Felix Gilbert, George Mussey, Hans Rosenberg, and others. In the humanities, science, art, music, cinema, the emigres hugely enriched their host countries. They were Hitler's gift. We associate this glittering exile especially with the USA, but the emigres fled to 80 different countries around the world. An important part of German history, therefore, in the 20th century, has to be written from London, Moscow, Jerusalem, Los Angeles, and Shanghai. European populations were, of course, also recast by the genocidal National Socialist War of Conquest. In the East, the waves of settlement, resettlement, and desettlement, as the jargon had it, these cost millions their lives and millions more their homes. In Germany, the reverse movement brought 8 million slave laborers into Germany by 1944. What was done by Germans in the East led then to the last desperate population movement of these years, the movement by flight or expulsion of 12 million Germans westward at the end of World War II, the greatest involuntary mass migration in European history. And so I reach 1945 and the years after, and want to ask the question finally, where did post-war German history happen? And the first answer, of course, is that it happened in two states, and the border between them was firmer than the border around either of them. As a result, Germany became a place where world history, in a sense, was staged. Berlin especially, the capital of the Cold War, from the airlift through JFK's famous visit to the tearing down of the wall in front of a global audience. Germany, Berlin, as a kind of stage of world history. Division also meant that two Germanies projected themselves into the world via cultural institutions, development aid, and sporting achievements. And if I concentrate in these last few minutes on the Federal Republic, that's not because I believe the GDR was a kind of footnote to German history, as Hans-Ulrich Wehler has argued. It's worth at least a sidebar. Now, that's a cheap shot. but because it does seem to me that the border-crossing transnational forces that I've been concerned with in this lecture flowed much more powerfully through one Germany than the other. I came into the world in 1949, the same year as the old Bonn Republic. I first visited that country in 1964, first lived there in 1971 as a doctoral student. Like many others, I've benefited from the cultural institutions that connected and connect this Germany to a wider world. Universities, Alexander von Humboldt Foundation, German historical institutes, and so on. These institutions brought non-Germans to study in Germany before they went back to their own countries, and they created German academic networks around the world. It would, of course, be possible to cite many examples of a German cultural presence globally. The standing of German painters in the international art market, the remarkable success of German publishers in buying up the New York publishing industry. But let me single out one individual who seems to me a characteristic figure of post-war transnational German culture. That's Ernst Joachim Behrendt. Jazz fans will recognize the name. This is the so-called jazz pope, whose jazz book, first published in 1953, has sold 1.5 million copies worldwide. Behrendt fostered an American music that had been driven underground during the Third Reich. He was a champion of European jazz, a pioneer in its globalization, and an advocate of the fusion of jazz with world music, as we now call it. If there was, as one critic said, a kind of one-world sentimentality in Behrendt, even a flight from Germanness, then that's perhaps not surprising in the son of a pastor from the Confessing Church who died at Dachau. These organizations and individuals helped forge a new place for Germany in the world beyond the political agreements and institutions that made the Federal Republic the most self-consciously multilateral of the major powers. The same is true of the citizens active in one or another of the world's 30,000 NGOs, international organizations concerned with cultural exchange, humanitarian relief, human rights, the environment. Those who were members of Greenpeace Deutschland or of the German Doctors Without Borders, Ärzte ohne Grenzen, these two are part of German history. The contemporary history of Germany in the world also, I think, needs to include subjects that sound banal, but were in fact truly important in changing the everyday lives of citizens in the Federal Republic. If we want to track how these people came to see themselves as Europeans, as well as Germans and Bavarians, then we need to look at the impact of consumption and tourism, of twin city exchanges, of au pairs, the Eurovision Song Contest, and, of course, football. Jürgen Klinsmann and Johannes Kepler, two socially mobile, footloose Swabians, in one lecture. It sounds strange, but I've included both of them with serious intent and as a kind of homage, if you want, to these two Swabians. The first German city in which I lived was Stuttgart, which was often described as Germany's largest village, and it certainly was 40 years ago. But it's also, it was then the city of choreographer John Cranko, of Daimler-Benz, and of the international style in architecture, for better or worse. And it was a city, this was in the early 70s, when I first lived there, a city in which the presence of Greek and Italian, not Turkish, Gastarbeiter was unmistakable. National history is simultaneously subnational, it takes place in Baden-Württemberg, but also supranational. It includes John Cranko, a Polish Briton, and Italian and Greek Gastarbeiter. I have tried to suggest in this lecture how the transnational perspective enriches our understanding. I don't want to make inflated claims, like political history, social history, cultural history. Transnational history is a construct. It's a cross-section through actual history, the complexity of history as we actually live it. But transnational history has special attractions. It shows us how much of German history actually took place beyond the borders of Germany. It draws our attention to networks and connections that have been overlooked. And it reminds us that Germany and German identity were less homogeneous than many believe or still want to believe. Transnational history doesn't dissolve or replace national history. Familiar landmarks remain. But from the Reformation to the present, to the Eurovision Song Contest and Jürgen Klinsmann, they look different. Thank you very much for your attention.
David, thank you very much for a fascinating lecture. Let's just give a minute for people to depart, and then I think I better struggle to my feet so I can see people in that corner as well, because we have, I think, a good 30 minutes for questions.
Good, Heather.
Off you go.
Yeah. I think there are microphones running around. Actually, there's Paul with a microphone here.
Thank you very much for a fascinating lecture and two quick questions that are actually interrelated. The first is, in your discussion of the 19th century, you left out in some ways what's the most transnational aspect, which is 1848 in Germany. And I was just wondering what were the reasons for that, not discussing the idea of revolution spreading across Europe. And obviously that brings us to the second question, drawing on from H.A.P. Taylor's argument that 1848 is the moment when Germany reached its turning point and failed to turn. Second question, what do your arguments do to our idea of the Sonderweg? And if we take a transnational approach, does that really dismantle a Sonderweg idea or not?
On the second question, I rather thought that the Sonderweg argument had already been dismantled. But you're quite right, I missed out 1848. You may have noticed I missed out the French Revolution too. I mean, I was probably loading, I mean, this is, though I hope it will be a short book, it will include the great political landmarks. The lecture was loaded towards, I suppose, non-political events, rightly or wrongly. I think there's a lot to be said about 1848, as there is indeed about the German Revolution of 1918 onwards, as events which not only does the German Revolution obviously follow, it's part of the domino effect of revolutions elsewhere, but the role of non-Germans fighting within Germany is important. So it's not just ideas, the stimulus that comes from abroad, but actually physically some of the fighting is done within Germany by non-Germans, which is also true again in 1918. So I think 1848 will certainly figure eventually in the account, and it cropped up right only slightingly in the lecture. Yeah, the Sonderweg. I mean, I try to avoid mentioning it these days, and
completely not to mention it, David. It's silence. Can I take the next question?
Please do. Yes.
Over there. There you go.
Thank you so much for this very interesting talk. I have a couple of questions as well. First of all, to what extent it makes sense to speak of German, the German lands of or German people, you know, in the 15th century? I mean, does it really make sense in historical terms? Because perhaps people back then didn't think of themselves as German, right? And the second question is, this is really big. The language. What about the language? It seems to me your talk presented us a tension between nationalism and cosmopolitanism, as it were.
Running nationalism
and cosmopolitanism, yes, yes. Running all throughout the history, yes, of Germany.
Yes.
But what about the language? I mean, sometimes the German language has been seen as a language of kind of, as a very local, kind of regional, parochial language, and sometimes it's seen as a means of communicating lots of people's, like the language of Mitteleuropa, for example, right? Like, okay. So, yeah.
Thank you, big questions. The first issue, I mean, it's, in many of the debates which have taken place among, you know, non-German historians about the transnational turn, if we can now call it that, this question has been raised: can one in fact have a transnational history in a pre-national age? Surely the transnational presupposes the existence of the national, and therefore we can only talk about these phenomena, strictly speaking, from the late 18th century or from the 19th century. That seems to me to be too constraining a view. My argument would be essentially pragmatic, that there are numerous books out there which write about, in both German and English, other languages, which write about German history in the Middle Ages, German history in the 16th century, German history in the early modern period. They write about German history as an overarching concept in full recognition, and I of course fully recognize it too, that that there is no nation state in this period, that this is still a pre-national era. The important point, it seems to me, is that if one wants to engage those historians who've written about German history, but without including these phenomena which link Germany to a wider world, one has to stray into this terrain from the High Middle Ages to the 19th century in order to enrich an existing narrative with what transnational history has to offer. Otherwise, one's restricted to writing about a much briefer modern period. I mean, one of the things I'm most committed to is to pushing history back before the very moderns. I have to say I become more committed the more I watch German history shrinking into the 20th century, but don't get me started on that. The last German Studies Association in the USA, 52% of all the papers were post-1945, another 25% were post-1914, everything else less than a quarter. I think it's really important not to neglect the early modern period. You are, of course, right. I mean, I would make a final justification for this, that it's not entirely arbitrary starting in 1500. I mean, and it's not only that this is the moment where the voyages of discovery and the Reformation coincide. It's also true that around 1500, German humanists are starting to talk about Germany. So there is justification there in the German language for this approach. Can I just, I don't want to take too long and stop other questions, but I've wanted to pick up one thing from your second question. You're quite right to point to the tension that I was painting between the national and the cosmopolitan. I think it's actually there's an extra dimension to it, and and it may be that I haven't fully worked it out yet. It seems to me that the transnational dimension operates in two different directions. One is what I called, you know, nice transnationalism. You know, it's the cosmopolitan, it's the networks of like-minded scholars, the Republic of Letters, the Humboldts, and it includes all those officials who cooperated with officials in other countries to produce international agreements. It's the benign face of globalization and transnationalism. But as I tried to show at various points, many of these practices themselves and the reactions to them paint a much darker picture. And the classic example would be those 20th century examples I gave of the of Germany providing the collaboration between non-European nationalists and conservative and even Nazi figures in Germany. So it's not just a story of the cosmopolitan being beaten down by the national. It includes a darker side. So does anyone have one question?
I think one at a time. You were next, I think. Yeah, and then I think, if possible, one question, please, not a string. It's a bit because I have about six or seven people in a row.
Okay. Actually, my question has already been asked in a way, so I'll try to do it in a slightly different way, so it's not too boring. I also wanted to ask about the early modern identity of Germany, because, I have an impression that to much extent, at least in the 16th century, the Dutchlands are still part of Germany, or rather maybe the Germanies, referred to usually in the plural. And on the other hand, we have a lot of ethnic Germans living outside the empire who are, very loyal subjects of their monarchs and are very willing to kill other ethnic Germans in the name of their monarchs. And I guess that such examples as Copernicus and Dantiscus would be very suggestive. So wouldn't it be like a bit more useful to replace the German identity in the 16th century with the imperial identity? And this, I guess, could be also a kind of explanation for the participation of the Germans in the Castilian colonial enterprise, because they were simply serving their emperor, who was also king of Castile. So this is like my question: what do you think about this imperial identity, which could serve as a kind of archaeology of the German identity?
Yeah. They're also serving the king of Portugal, who wasn't the emperor. I mean, they were serving many foreign princes, and that's. I think. I mean, the imperial identity is only one. I mean, you can. I think you have to see the identities of the 16th century as being multiple. They're certainly local. I mean, if you were from Nuremberg or Augsburg, you were very aware of being from Nuremberg or Augsburg. Then, extraordinary prosperous cities with a kind of global reach, the mercantile networks. Reich identity for some, yes. Others, as you say, they serve foreign monarchs. I mean, these identities are not incompatible with each other. And if you look at the humanists, there's a kind of proto-German national identity which I think coexists with these other identities. So I mean, you ask if it's useful. I mean, it's useful not to lose sight of the imperial identity, but I think it would be less than useful to try and restrict the identity of those who lived within the empire solely to that identity. The German Dutch issue. Yes, this is a very vexed one. It persists in labels like the Pennsylvania Dutch, who are in fact the Pennsylvania Germans, or are they in fact Dutch? There's continuing controversy over whether that settlement I mentioned in Germantown, whether they are in fact Dutch or German. The truth is that they were Dutch, but they then lived in Krefeld, which is strictly on the German side of the border. So they were both Dutch and German. The Dutch-German border is exceptionally fluid in those years. You're absolutely right about that.
Hang on a minute, wait for the microphone.
Could I suggest that there's something about the specific German experience, the fact that Germany was a cultural unity but never a political unity, has meant that Germans have made an extraordinary important contribution to transnational state structures, if you like. I'm thinking in terms of the way the extent to which the European Union is modelled on the experience of the Zollverein. I'm thinking of the fact that Germans have lived in confederations or federations apart from the Third Reich, again, this provides a kind of model for the way the European Union might develop. And the final point is the importance that Germans have played in the international communist and socialist movement. That, of course, German was the language of the Comintern, and the intention was to base the Communist International in Berlin. Of course, this anticipated German revolution that was so important to the Bolsheviks. So there's something about German history that I think, you're right, it lends itself to this cross-border analysis. But I'd suggest also the same is true for Britain, for quite different reasons as well.
I leave it to others to talk about Britain. I mean, obviously, if there are comparisons, there are also, you know, fundamental dissimilarities between Germany and Britain. But I agree with what you say. I mean, both the point about the international socialist and communist movements is very well taken. And so too is the Germany as a sort of repository of federal models, of non-centralizing models. Not the only one, but an important one. And I'll just add one other thing, which will eventually, I mean, you know, many things were excluded from this lecture, and the audience, bit by bit, you know, raising questions about all of them. One of them is one other German contribution to the contemporary world is the contribution of the Holocaust as kind of as the world's civics lesson. And I don't mean that facetiously. It seems to me that it is very striking how the Holocaust has become internationalized as the moral lesson which is taught in the schools. Both of my children had it three times at different stages of their schools. I mean, that's one side of which the other side is the way in which Hitler has provided an endless series of false analogies right through to Saddam Hussein, particularly when it comes to appeasement. But I'm straying from your questions. I have nothing to add other than my strong agreement with the points you make about the federal and the role in international movements. Thank you.
My question is specific about the relationship between Turkey and Germany during the before the First World War and during. They were very friendly. Why is this change of attitude now? Is it because of migration or because of some wider political context?
I think that there are others in this room much better qualified than I to comment on this, but it seems to me that the big obstacle, which rarely in the minds of Germans as in the minds of French politicians, rarely spoken out loud, is the fear of very large numbers of Muslims becoming part of the European Union. Isn't that the basic issue? If you're talking about EU admission. But German politicians in World War I were not inviting Turkey to become part of a European Union. I mean, I think the circumstances change cases. But I mean, if you're asking about present day anxieties, it seems to me that that's where they are to be found.
Yeah. I have a quick question about the German Empire. It seems to me that in recent years there's been a renewed emphasis on the influence of the German colonial experience in the development of racial ideas in Germany itself, and particularly with the Herero genocide playing sort of the part as a general rehearsal, if you will, for the Holocaust. And how much truth do you think there is in his view? To what extent were these, you know, views on race that became dominant in Germany a product of the colonial era?
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's a very important question. My answer is a sort of measured one. It's sort of to some extent. I think that the work, it's a huge body of work that's arisen recently, on the continuities of ideas and even in some cases of personnel, but also in some of the lowering of thresholds in what Germans are willing to do. There is some evidence that this does have an impact. Against that, this is where the true German Empire being in Eastern Europe comes back in. I do think that the real roots of what Germans did to Slavs in Eastern Europe lies in their relations with Slavs in Eastern Europe and with the German history in Eastern Europe, which goes back to, you know, to colonization in the High Middle Ages. But in the modern era, already in the late 19th century, you can see a mounting hostility towards Slavs, reflected in the hostility towards these Polish migrant labourers, but also to be found in huge amounts of writing on heroic writing about German colonization of Slav lands in the Middle Ages, and in fictional portrayals of the same thing. So, insofar as we're looking for the roots of the Holocaust and the killing of Soviet POWs, for example, insofar as we're looking for the roots of these, I think they're more to be found in German relations with Eastern Europe than they are with this, but it plays some role.
I think Neil's next, and I strongly suspect he can bellow loud enough without a microphone, but still, here it comes.
David, it's a privilege to hear you give a formal lecture. As colleagues, we more usually talk about these things over an improvised cup of tea at the Günzburg Centre, and I really enjoyed this. I have a question and a wee suggestion. The question has to do with the failure of Germany's super cosmopolitan universities. We are at a very cosmopolitan university, and normally we teach at equally cosmopolitan university, and there is an assumption in the early 21st century that the exchanges that are promoted by universities, transnational exchanges, are necessarily good. And yet, when you compare German universities in the 1920s with almost any other universities in the world, they're the most international. Heidelberg makes Oxford look unbelievably parochial and chauvinistic right up until the early 30s. Mm-hmm. So my question is, have you got an answer to what went wrong with this great experiment in transnational higher education? The suggestion is whether this book, and it's going to be a book, is going to be chronological, as your lecture was. I wonder whether this will work better as a transperiodical as well as transnational study. And have you considered arranging it thematically, explorers, academics, migrants, rather than chronologically? Thanks.
Oh, thank you, Neil. When you asked the question, you asked it in such a way that it almost invited the answer that things went wrong after 1933, when clearly the real question is not, I suppose, why German universities became nativist and closed off in the Third Reich. It's why, in circumstances after 1945 or after 1949, when in their different ways, both German states were not closing themselves off from the world, why the universities nonetheless did not take that, did not return to what they'd been. And I don't have a good answer to that. That's from one perspective. I mean, I suppose one would have to look at whether those universities were as attractive as they had been in an earlier period. Is it not your impression that even in the early 20th century, some of the extraordinary kind of dominance of German learning and its prestige had started to wear a bit thin? So even had there been, to do the counterfactual, which will appeal to you, even had there been no Hitler, that German universities would have gradually become less cosmopolitan than they had been in the 19th century. It seems to me possible. But I think the question is why they didn't revert to type after World War II. And I don't have a particularly good answer. I think that a thematic organization would, I was going to say, I think it would make life too easy for me. Obviously, it wouldn't be all that easy, because trying to move across a category like migration from 1500 to 2000 would create its own problems. But the main, I'm pretty sure I won't do that. And the reason is that I want the chronology in there. And I want those political turning points that the first questioner asked about. Because I don't want this to be a history of Germany that sits apart from and alongside existing histories, but one which actually engages with existing turning points. So I want it to engage with the 30 Years' War. There was almost nothing on that today, but I will be writing about that. The 30 Years' War, that whole period of revolutionary upheaval of the late 18th, early 19th century, and again World War One. I'm thinking of probably having a series of shorter chapters on these rupture points where I try and present them as kind of contact zones where war and revolution creates often unwittingly, for example with the dispersal of emigrants, creates greater contacts with the world. But I don't want to lose those political turning points. And that's, I think, one of the great virtues of Tom Bender's book on America, is that he's taking kind of canonical episodes, the Founding Fathers, the Revolution, the Civil War, and looking at them through a new lens rather than creating a narrative which sits apart from traditional accounts, thereby making it harder for his more inward-looking colleagues to ignore his work. Not to say, of course, that German historians are inward-looking, but that would be my main reason for trying to stick to the chronology. But thank you.
Alan. Yeah. Is a microphone coming over your shoulder, Alan?
David, thanks again for the lecture. I'm sure from now on I'm going to get students coming up to ask me, what is the difference between international history and transnational history? And if you've given a lecture on, you know, Germany 1500 to 2000, an international history for an annual lecture, then that would just save me that problem. But never mind. The question I want to ask is, since you started off with a quote, I think, from Goethe about where is Germany, where are the borders, etc. If I can link that to the fact that obviously the Germans have this trouble on part of their history of precisely defining where they are, that I think may have led to the dark side of transnational history, as you might put it, and that is the fear of the outside and the fear of encirclement and Einkreisung as a kind of factor of the German experience, which I think goes back way to the 30 Years' War. It's not just a 20th century problem at all. They've got the French on one side, the Baltic peoples, the Swedes, the Danes, the Poles later on. And this must affect not just the military history of Germany, but also cultural and other aspects, psychological aspects of German history. So do you have a sort of dialectic, or do you see a sort of tension in German history between those looking out and seeing people to be feared, and then others having more benign connections with the outside world? Can we sort of see Germany in that way?
Thanks, Alan. I think I would agree with it, that there is that kind of dialectic, that kind of interplay between the two. They're the two currents which, in answering that earlier question, I mean, I see as the, as it were, the benign cosmopolitan face and the darker side. On the larger question of framing and, you know, the country in the middle, this is tricky terrain. Well, it's a literally terrain. And when I was a young scholar, geography and the geographical interpretation of history was held in very low esteem. That's partly because it was a different age of geography. The geographers were very different, and geographically inflected history tended to be, well, very determinist. As you know, German geographically inflected history more determinist than the French variety, and even the French variety, particularly the Braudelian kind, was thought of as being rather determinist. When that was narrowed in turn to its military dimension, then this is where I came in, where the German social historians of an early era came in. I now have a lot more time for geography. I think We all have. I mean, the spatial dimension has come back in with a vengeance. And it now includes, as you say, not just the military dimension, but the many other dimensions. You started by talking about international and transnational. It's one of the reasons it's increasingly hard to tell the difference is because international history has itself become the new international history, and therefore people who practice it tend to write about malaria and imported circus animals and things rather than about Metternich. So we've a whole new world has emerged.
There are a few Walton Sods there.
an example picked entirely at random.
I think we'll have one more question, and then I think David deserves to have some dinner.
Thank you. I'm not sure if my question is an appropriate one, but I think because it concerns the future, but looking forward, what do you think is the role of Germany going to be in the 21st century as we go forward, maybe in the context of the European Union?
You know what they say, the only things historians can predict is the past, and they're not particularly good even at that. Germany in the future. This is the kind of question one gets, of course, at the Center for European Studies much more often than in gatherings of historians. It's never particularly welcome being invited to speculate about these unknowable things. I don't see any fundamental shifts. You should really ask my colleagues sitting here in the front row. I don't see any fundamental shifts in the kind of the German stance towards the world. And that's partly because of the very high degree, I think, still of partisanship in German politics. And I don't see any fundamental change in the relatively modest political profile that Germany shows to the world. I think that you can expect Germany to continue to create huge numbers of green jobs and probably be selling green technology to Japan as well as California after recent events. And to continue to... I mean, one of the wonderful things about the so-called coming to terms with the past is that it never ends. And part of the ritual of coming to terms with the past, the Nazi past, is that periodically people say, time to draw a line, and other people say, no, it's never time to draw the line. And that will continue. That will continue to be a part of German self-understanding, I think, for decades more to come. In other words, Germany will continue to recognize that its past history constitutes the world's civics lesson. So that, along with the, I think, the continuing political, more or less political position, and the emphasis on multilateralism, which is a German speciality, will continue. And those German consuls that one always meets will continue to wear those uniform, those sort of the dark blazers and the striped ties. Never met a German consul who didn't. It must be a special issue, and I see no sign of that changing anytime soon. So.
Great, David. Thank you very much for coming to talk to us. It was lovely seeing you again. Hope you come back, and it was a splendid lecture. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.